Okay, is everybody back?
I am.
Okay.
We're back.
I can see on the website, but there does seem to be a delay from when it actually happens, and then maybe 1 or 2 seconds later, the website reflects it.
Unbelievable. I mean, it's still pretty remarkable that we can get that kind of data.
Yeah. what I thought I would do today, is that I did give a talk explicitly about the Climate Literacy Network at AGU this year. In the past, many of the presentations about the Climate Literacy Network have been embedded in the clean presentations, but this time I gave a presentation that was explicitly about the Climate Literacy Network, and I thought I would share that today with everybody, since actually a number of you who are on the phone, your names actually appeared on this abstract and on this presentation, and most of you have not even seen what was in it. And I apologize for that. I hadn't intended that, but there was a proposal deadline also that week, and it was a struggle to get to preparing the presentation because I was struggling to get the proposal done. So I decided I would share it with you now, and hopefully those of you whose names actually were associated with it, that you afterwards are still okay with that. But before we get to that, I want to have any announcements that people may have.
This is Linda.
Uh-huh.
I'm excited to share that we've just achieved our first real innovation in engineering at the Waste Divide. They got their first replicate core, so deviated off the borehole and got new ice at critical periods of time. So everybody's very excited about that achievement.
So just so that everybody knows, define what waste is, because I don't know that everybody does know.
Oh, sorry. This is the West Antarctic Ice Sheet, deep ice drilling site, and they had completed drilling ice cores for past climate data all the way to the bedrock last year, and this year we're taking on trying to create a new engineering technique of drilling into the uphill side of the borehole and deviating off the main core to get additional replicate core for additional research. And this was a huge challenge, and so it's really awesome that they achieved that, and everybody's excited.
So this is they put the drill in, and then they deviate off of the original hole. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and nothing like this has ever been done anywhere before. So people have been able to deviate and drill parallel cores in the oil business, but they always do it on sort of the downhill side where it's gravity's assisting. And we could not do that because after the core is pulled out, there's all kinds of technologies that are utilized to log the borehole itself and to send, you know, light back into the ice sheets from inside the ice sheet and so forth. So any cutting or ledge work that's done on the downhill side would trap and mess up all of those instruments. So they had to actually, you know, put in new actuators and have the drill bend upwards, if you can think of that.
Mm.
And then so it's an amazing thing that they were able to pull off. It was tested and then revised a lot last summer because they weren't successful last year, and now it's up and running. So that's hot news off the ice.
And you're going to get to go see this, right, Linda?
I am. Is that you, Jim?
Yes, it is.
Yes. Oh, hi. Yeah, I'm getting to see it in 2 weeks.
Terrific. Well, congratulations. Yeah. So, Doug,
thanks.
Did you have a question? I thought you had a question.
It was Frank. Linda,
Frank.
Do you have any sense of how far back in time this previous core, the new standard of depth, goes back in time?
Not the one that was just drilled yesterday, but in terms of last year, the Waste Divide deepest depths was about 62,000 years ago. And they're starting much higher than that or earlier in time to capture changes from, you know, cold to hot periods. Basically, there's several targeted depths that they're going to be drilling at, not the whole one, but where changes have occurred, they're trying to really look back at other factors that might have caused abrupt climate change during those transitions.
Did you say 62 or 620?
62,000, which is much younger than they thought. And one of the Gary Clow, who does borehole logging, he does temperature profiles, was down there last year and was basically astounded by how young the ice was. And the theory is because it's on a rift zone there, and there's he found about five times the normal geothermal flux coming up, that the older layers of ice may have melted off underneath the waste divide. So that was a surprise to the community that it is as young as it is down at the bottom.
And Tamara, this is Doug. I do have a news flash when you're ready.
Okay. Okay, well, that's great, Linda. Thanks a lot, and congratulations. And you can tell us more about it once you get to go see it.
Yes.
Okay, so go ahead, Doug.
Hi. And just last week, there was that post by the Portland, Oregon public TV person, and I happened to call her that day and gave some recommendations of people in the group and on the call, so I don't know if anyone else has responded to her. But I recommended Gary Brosh and Mark and Frank as potential contacts for what she was reaching out for. And she's kind of been, I don't know if she's maybe on the call, but I just gave her some personal insight of who to reach out to.
Okay. All right, great, thanks. Any other announcements? So we did get emails today from Don and Karen and about the Next Generation Science Standards, which it sounds like January 8th is a date that they're going to open it up for public comment again. So we will schedule accordingly. That 8th does happen to be a Tuesday. So since we will not, nobody will have had time to actually reflect on them, we'll have a call that day, obviously, but we will probably just strategize and plan to have our meaty discussions the two subsequent weeks, assuming that that all fits within the time frame of which we can get feedback back to them. I just wanted to let everybody know that if you haven't seen the emails today. The other thing that I wanted to mention was that after the AGU meeting, Mark McCaffrey and his group at NCSE organized and ran a climate and energy literacy initiative, a strategic planning summit that Frank was at, a number of us were at. I did hope that Mark could be on the call, but he unfortunately is ill and was not. So I'm just going to just say a little bit about what it was, and then if after I do my little reprise of the AGU presentation, we can incorporate that into our discussions. But I just wanted everybody to be aware of this. It was a summit that brought together about 50 people crossing a wide range of stakeholders in climate literacy. So beyond just explicit educators and scientists, but people from all different kinds of informal education institutions from community action groups and from funders and from other think tanks. And so the way this the meeting was structured is we were broken into thematic working groups in the morning of the first day. And each of these groups had a spectrum of people around the table representing a wide range of expertise. And the topics that were addressed were learning and literacy, what matters, technology and tools, what works, research and evaluation, measuring success, psychology and sociology, the affective domain, access and deployment, marketing literacy, partnerships and collaborations, a shared vision, and funding and administration, aggregating resources. And so the discussions and summaries of those discussions were captured in a Google document, and then each of those groups broke into new audience-focused groups in the afternoon. With the attempt was to have at least one person from each of the morning groups on each of the afternoon groups, which addressed K-8 formal education, 9-12 formal education, post-secondary education, informal science and environmental organizations, media and communications, policymakers and legislatures, and religion and social justice organizations. And again, there was conversations for the afternoon, and then a summary. And then the following morning, we had discussions, an entire group discussion around short-term, medium-term, and long-term goals. And NCSE is going to take all of this input and put it into a white paper that will be will have Mark and those people, the rest of the people who participated, possibly make a more formal presentation about the outcomes of that meeting and how we might connect to it, because I think that there's a lot that was discussed there that is of great interest to this community, and I see them as parallel in a lot of ways. So I don't know if Frank or anybody else who was there want to add anything to that right now. We can discuss this further in a little bit.
Thank you, Tamara. I think we discussed this some for some of us on last week's meeting, but yep. I think one of the key things that I'll expand on your remarks, Tamara, is I believe there's interest of the convening organization, NCSE, to have that white paper be commented on, modified, and I'm not sure exactly how they plan to or how we all plan to kind of socialize and deepen that work, but I think that was part of the conversation, so I'm not sure how that's going to work, but I think that members of the network would be keenly interested on that piece of the work.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, any other announcements, or we can get on to my little presentation?
Tamara?
Yes?
Will you pass on the white paper to this group once it comes out?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
That would be awesome. Thank you so much.
Okay, we'll move on to giving you basically information about the Climate Literacy Network, some of it history for those of you who are newer, and some of you have participated for a while. I actually got all these numbers together literally the day or so before the presentation. So, although we had been accumulating them for a while. So, with that, we can start. So, if everybody has the slides, you'll notice the names of my co-authors: Scott Carley, Frank Niepold, Don Dugenhans, Karen Holwig, and Mark McCaffrey. These are all people who have been very involved in various aspects of the Climate Literacy Network and help move this forward. Obviously, there's others of you who have participated significantly, but at the time we put this together, I just wanted to make sure. I didn't want this to seem like it was coming just from me. So hopefully those of you who are seeing this for the first time and names appear there, you're okay with what comes next. So if I go to the next slide, this is for a little bit of background. The Climate Literacy Network was formed in January of 2008, right after the first version of the Climate Literacy Essential Principles were published. There were about 20 members. We met at the National Council for Science and the Environment's meeting in Washington, D.C. And basically, we just felt that there was this small group of 20 people felt that there was a need that we should now that these climate literacy essential principles were established, and there was a newer version that was published a year later that we all use now, that we needed to really be able to get this out into as many different contexts as we could. And so a group formed then, and then so we've grown. One of the first activities that grew, the major activity, we did some white papers early on, but then the first proposal, the clean proposal, was funded in 2010, grew out of conversations at the Climate Literacy Network. And then to see how we've grown, and in December of 2012, just before the AGU meeting, we had 379 members. And we were also very much involved in the establishment of the energy literacy principles that were published in 2012. So if we go to the next slide. Now, you all are probably interested. I've tried to put over time, I've tried to put together a map of the distribution of Climate Literacy Network members. Early on, we didn't actually have contact information for everybody. Now, and so I think maybe probably a year to a year and a half into it, I sent an email out to the Climate Literacy Network asking all members to provide me with their contact information, affiliations, what their expertise was, so we could get a sense of it. So the list is not 100% correct, complete, I mean, but it's good, because now anytime I add somebody, I do gather that information as we add people. So this is a distribution. We have at least someone from all but five states, so with Massachusetts and California being the largest, although you see that little square on the left that says state unknown, what means is that there's somebody who's a member of the Climate Literacy Network, and there's at least 25 or more of them for which we didn't have contact information, and so they're not represented here on the map. But anyway, so that the coverage was better than I had anticipated. I wasn't sure if we were really concentrated all in a couple of states or a few states, or whether we really did have broad reach. So this certainly can be improved on, but we are reaching out across the cross country. Okay, if you go to the next slide, most of you are really familiar with this. We have weekly teleconferences and an active listserv. And members of the Climate Literacy Network try to leverage the expertise that's in the Climate Literacy Network to gain guidance on individual efforts. We organize sessions for various meetings. The most prominent ones are AGU, GSA, NAAEE, and NSTA. And we, as you already know, we provide input to documents relevant to climate literacy, such as the Next Generation Science Standards most recently, and in the past to the Climate Literacy Essential Principles and the Energy Literacy Principles. And we are involved in various, we try to really develop lots of partnerships, and we have the clean activities, which are ongoing. Go to the next slide. It just sort of represents all the organizations that are kind of, that have been involved with clean in terms of the funding. Turk Series and CERC have been the main organizations that have been involved in the initial funding for 3 years, which the 3 years is at the end of this month, but we did get a supplement from the Department of Energy to facilitate the energy curriculum developers, and we'll be leveraging the Climate Literacy Network calls to bring that community together, so you'll be hearing from those people over the next year. So the funding actually goes for a little bit longer, but the level of funding is rather low for that. We have, through our partnership with Frank at NOAA, we now have ongoing funding for at least 2013. So if we go to the next slide, just to give you an overview of the impact we've had with respect to presentations at professional meetings. We started organizing the sessions at the AGU last year, and we had five sessions and about 100 papers. This year, we had six sessions, eight oral and six poster sessions with about 170 papers. And last year, we had a little bit of trouble getting them to buy into letting us help organize the sessions. So while we had each of our sessions labeled as climate literacy, and then the focus of that particular climate literacy session, we got combined with sessions that were outside of that. And this year, they really allowed us to combine the sessions in a way that made sense when any particular session didn't get enough papers. And it really increased our impact tremendously. They also allowed us to request a schedule, which is unheard of in my experience with organizing sessions at AGU. So we've had quite a presence there. We organized two sessions for the GSA annual meeting this year. We also had one last year, I believe, but I really couldn't find the details of that. NAAEE, we've coordinated. It's a little bit different there because we don't actually propose sessions. We propose more or less presentations. And so we've put together a coordinated suite of presentations in which then we put together a one-page flyer that we have at the meeting so that people who are interested in climate literacy sessions can kind of find all of those. We've done this in 2010, 11, and 12. In addition to those presentations, we've had a Climate Literacy Network roundtable, which is basically in a big ballroom, a couple of round tables where members of the Climate Literacy Network there sort of talking about the Climate Literacy Network to anybody who's interested in engaging people in joining and letting people know what we're doing. And then we've been also active in the tri-agency climate change education community. So those are the major activities with respect to that. If we go to the next slide, as everybody is really familiar with now, it's just our teleconference page, so I won't dwell on that one. But the next graph might be interesting. This is new information to everybody here. The teleconferences, I alluded to at the beginning of our call that I could see online when people were reattached after I started the recording. Well, we get a report of how many people were actually on the call, and what we count here is not necessarily all the calls, because let's say if somebody calls in and their phone line drops and they call in again, well, that might count as two calls. But I use the number here of the number of simultaneous lines open. And so this represents information from August 13, 2010, when we started using the global conference to September 18, 2012. In that time, we had 111 teleconferences. And of those 111, we had 52 presentations, and the average number of participants was 13. And as everybody knows, the slides and the recordings of the teleconference are posted. But you can see that there's quite a number of spikes in this graph here, so that while the average number is 13, you can see that it's ranged up to, in some of these spikes, the 40s and 50s. And so on the right-hand side of this slide, I identified for each of those spikes, what was the topic? These are all presentations except for the last two. So we had in 2010, the Council for Environmental Deans and Directors gave a presentation that was essentially about the CAMEL project. Mm-hmm. And then in February 2011, NASA's Global Climate Change website presentation was very highly attended. And I did see Laura Tenenbaum during the AGU meeting, and she says there's new things on the site. She'd like to give another presentation. So I said, that sounds great. And then last January, I gave a presentation about the Clean Review Services and what we could make available to the CSEP Phase 2 proposers and anybody else who was interested in submitting a proposal to any other solicitation related to climate resources. And that was actually our peak. We had 52 participants that day. And then, as you might expect, Earth the Operator's Manual was another really high peak. And then Mark's presentation about lessons learned from the evolution trenches from NCSE, that was a highly attended teleconference. And then our two teleconferences in May around providing input to the draft Next Generation Science standards was also highly attended. So we really appreciate that. So that was one avenue of information that I have. And the other was going to the listserv. So if you go to the next slide, this is a listserv volume. So the listserv is all archived, and you can actually go back to any of into the archive. It's linked right from the teleconference page. You can go to the archive, so you can look at old messages. And so you actually, just in case you're not aware, if you missed a string of conversations, that you don't have to go looking for all those emails. You could go into the listserv archive and look it up. And so this is, we started the listserv, I guess, in September of 2009. That was the earliest that was archived on the site. And up through, I had the numbers for up through August of 2012. And the average volume per month has been about 74 messages. But you can see that the number is growing. We have, in 2012, we had 94 messages per month. And that's been for 8 months. So. And then the example topics of discussion, there's a few peaks there that I just went in and looked at some of them. June 2011 seemed to be a very active month, and we were talking about the climate of denial, global warming and climate change, the truth, and extreme weather and climate change. And then in April of 2012, we had quite a high volume. And that first night in there, capturing the interest of disinterested students, was really an interesting case in which there was a middle school teacher in Germany who asked if she could post a question to the Climate Literacy Network that she had posted on her Facebook page and didn't get much response. Well, she got tremendous response. I think it elicited a two-week, very useful discussion on our web, our listserv. So then there's others around energy, the debate on how to teach evolution and climate change, and then the panel discussions on future Climate Literacy Network calls. So that was this is the volume we've had on our listserv. It's a very active listserv. So the rest, I also showed people the list of partners we have in case people haven't. We have been approached by NOVA's Energy Labs and asked to be an outreach partner, so we now appear on their website and they appear on ours, and we're going to be going further with beyond just the Energy Labs. We're going to be having a conversation with them in January, so it's another avenue of reaching out further. Everybody knows about our Facebook page, or if not, it's there, and people are welcome to join the Facebook page. It could be more active. We do post there. We try to post there regularly, but it's rather slow now. But it's an avenue where we can try to exploit further. And then this was the last slide in the presentation. The next slide after the Facebook page slide. But if you go two more, and we can just use this for conversation. This was just in case people ask these questions. The 14th slide is the list of climate literacy sessions we had at AGU, and the 15th slide is a list of climate literacy sessions we had at GSA. So since we thought we could continue this discussion, if anybody has questions or if people wanted to know more about what happened at AGU, I had that list of sessions there. So that was my presentation. I hope that those of you who are listed as co-authors are okay with the content. And
of course.
Questions?
Great.
Tamara, could we go back to slide 11 for a second?
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that Skeptical Science Group did at AGU was they shared, they blogged, they tweeted. Out of the 170 specific sessions on climate literacy with posters and oral sessions, and then there were public affairs and union and other sessions that related to climate literacy. That were outside of the set in the education set. Some of those findings got shared out through social media, but you had expressed interest in maybe the clean Facebook page could be the space for other members of the community to share what's being said. A lot of people were using their phones to take photographs to capture a slide. That had usually there was a citation. There were a lot of citations that people would whip out their cameras and grab that citation. But I think that there were a lot of people in the rooms ranging from 30 to over capacity. But there didn't seem to be a spot for all of us to share our work with each other in the social media space. And the literacy, the tri-agency leads. From NOAA, NASA, and NSF-MET, and they talked about this issue, and they'd asked that maybe we could help solve that problem. And I mentioned this to you, and your first response was this page is perhaps where that space could be. So I thought maybe it would be good for us to talk about that quickly, about whether or not we all agree, and if we agree, then would we use this space for where we share related climate literacy work.
I think that's an excellent use of this page, and I find it difficult myself to put any large amount of volume up there. But if each of us could begin to share information on the Facebook page, it could elicit a lot of additional interactions and sharing that would be quite valuable, I think. Have others been involved in posting significant amounts of material on Facebook?
Come on, guys. Let's,
maybe the question is how many of us use Facebook?
Just a little.
I can say that most of the professional organizations I belong to are all moving this direction, and there's lots of talking going on and lots of experimenting going on, and no one has the, quote, right professional answer on this one. But social media has been the topic at least three meetings I've been to in the last couple of months.
Okay, so it sounds to me like, I mean, one of the things that I have realized over the past few years is we've experimented with using Facebook for clean and my even having my own personal Facebook page and interacting with my daughters who have Facebook pages, is that there's those who are, you know, sort of like 25 and younger, and they
yep.
use this kind of thing fluently, and those people who are 25 and older tend not to. And I think it's just a mindset and a way of communicating that that's just different. And what I think that we really do need to do is to find a way that we can, because one of the, that's a community, that younger community is a community we really want to engage. And so to find a way of bridging that, even if you don't use Facebook personally, it might be worthwhile in terms of your own experimenting, if there's thing when you are at one of these professional meetings or that has materials relevant to climate, this could be a way that you could experiment in it and also then contribute to increasing the traffic on the clean Facebook page. One of the things I've been told by people that I've talked to with respect to the social media is that if you can get conversations going, if there's enough volume, if you're posting often, then it sort of builds a following. And it takes more than just the people funded on a particular project. We're just all, I mean, in terms of clean, we've managed to identify to things to post at least on a regular basis, but they're not frequent enough to elicit a lot of conversation. But this may be a way, a place where if enough of us say, okay, we're going to this meeting, we'll each pledge to post 5 or 10 things over the course of the meeting, you know, not committing yourself to beyond the meeting, but it's a way of sort of experimenting yourself and seeing how you could make it reaching out to others. I don't know. That's just an idea on my part, trying to find ways of doing this without overwhelming anybody.
Tamara,
right.
This is Jim. And the AMS Education Program has had Facebook pages associated with the students and faculty that have participated in our courses for a long time. But we just established sort of a general presence on Facebook and Twitter for the education program. And this has really, really become very active, and we're very pleased with the way it has turned out. And it's we've made new friends that way, and new people are interested in the things that we offer, and it's really come around. The meteorological community is quite into Facebook. I've got, you know, three former hurricane director Facebook friends and stuff like that. A lot of the broadcast meteorologists are on, so it's not that unusual to have older people in the meteorological community on Facebook, and many of them are very, very active.
So what did you say that these Facebook and Twitter are focused on which communities?
We just have one for the AMS education program, just sort of a general open page that we monitor. And we post things up there that we find from various people. We of course, gather information, kind of current events information on weather, climate, and ocean. And we post stuff about that. We've got a lot of faculty out there that find interesting stuff, and they post on our course pages, and then we'll often put that on the Facebook page for the general education program. At AGU, we had quite a few posts from the meeting where people came to our booth and we took a picture and, you know, talked about some topic, and we had quite a few people following that.
I think that's really exciting, and I can imagine that who would really get going on this is students that are committed to various aspects of the climate change picture. And this could be geology clubs, it could be meteorology clubs, so it can be sort of that informal set of students that are at the college level, or it can be kids that are taking classes there and their instructors that are involved with
But how do you inform them that this is there, or do they just stumble across it?
Well, that's what I was going to say, is probably AG, you know, the conferences that you're going to right now are the places to let them know this is out there. Do you mm-hmm. have a list of people on Climate Literacy Network that are faculty?
We can guess at that. I mean, we can tell when people are affiliated with the university if they've given us their contact information that includes that.
Yep.
What I can't say is that they're actually faculty.
But they're affiliated with universities in one way or another.
Right. So we could identify, we can identify approximately. I won't say that we're 100% because, like I said, we don't have everybody's contact information, but we can identify universities.
I never managed to find the Clean Facebook page until you just mentioned it, and I just liked it. And so I think some of these things are just sort of happenstance.
Yeah. So, but there are potentially avenues that we could try to exploit. Like we could. Another thing that I'll let everybody know is during the Climate and Energy Literacy Summit that we just talked about earlier. I talked extensively to Pranati from AGU, who's their education and outreach person, and where she's asked that I put together an EOS article about one of the things we want to do is to get expert science reviews for the clean resources, but we can certainly advertise the clean Facebook page through that avenue, and there was other avenues she had ideas about in terms of reaching out to that community.
So Tamara, one thing as I'm looking at the clean website is mm-hmm. that, I mean, we've had this kind of not schism but incomplete identity between clean and the Climate Literacy Network, and they both have network in them, but they both have climate literacy, but when you look at the clean Facebook page. It says the about section is only about clean. It, mm-hmm. it doesn't really connect to the climate literacy piece. And so one thing, if we're going to, you know, make this the clean page, the wider literacy network and clean page, just so we get some efficiency, we may want to, you know, edit the about page to be a little bit more expansive.
Yeah, no, we will. We've been working on really, truly integrating clean in the Climate Literacy Network. We are going to be revising the pages of the website itself, and you're right, that can extend to this. We are working on that. We've sort of put together a report of the needs of the content of those pages, and that's why the Climate Literacy Network page on the clean page just has a lot of content right now that's not organized in any real efficient or effective way. But I agree that this can be expanded to include the Climate Literacy Network.
And the one other thing I was going to say is one of the nice features that's in Facebook, I'm not finding it right now, is SlideShare, which is, I was sitting at AGU looking as convener at, you know, piles of PowerPoints and keynotes that were just spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they're no longer available to us. And it would be a lot of work to get all those posters and presentations gathered together again, but it's something we do a lot of, and you know, we could I think it's easy to share them in Facebook if we wanted to do that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh,
yeah, okay,
nice.
So that's interesting to look into. Okay, so one thing everybody can do is you can send out to all of your networks that the Clean Facebook page is out there and get more people starting to look at it.
This is Alan in Berkeley. I just have a couple of comments about it. I think that it, one thing is that your comment about younger people and older people is probably spot on, and we might need Facebook for old fuddy-duddies session as to how to, what are the ways to do it. The other comment I have, though, is that I think any of this is going to require somebody to actually shepherd, a particular. I know that's true for Twitter. I mean, a Twitter is not interesting unless somebody is actually putting Twitter posts up. So if you have a Twitter, if you have a Twitter entity, it's going to be dead unless somebody is actually actively.
Well, that's one of the reasons we haven't actually done that.
Yeah. But I think the same applies to Facebook. If somebody mm-hmm. is not focusing on making it alive and with vitality,
mm-hmm.
it's not going to be of as much interest.
Well, we understand that, but we have to balance between what's financially possible, and so we do have somebody who puts together something that will regularly post to our Facebook page, but she's paid very minimally on the Clean Project to do that. So that we do have occasionally, we do have on a semi-regular basis new posts. However, I agree, to keep things really going and vibrant, you need much more time. And it would be nice to be able to have, a college student or a graduate student who might be really emotionally vested in the topic to move this along. But we don't have that right now.
Tamara, between CERC and CERES, both of them are associated with two academic institutions and others on the call, that shouldn't be that hard. But opening that the ask might
mm-hmm.
help us there. But I agree with I agree that that's a good place.
Mm-hmm.
Can any of you explain to me the distinction between when you would post something on Facebook versus when you would send it out to the listserv?
Facebook is more of an announcement kind of thing. At least this is from my perspective. And sometimes you would send it to both. But, in fact,
is there any way to link the two so that...
I would send a list out to the listserv. I mean, a memo to the listserv to ask everybody to get on the Facebook page. And Facebook would be a better communication piece, probably, than
that's
the...
only true. That's only true when people feel like they're comfortable using it. And so far, it's mostly been people are much more comfortable with the email.
Right.
And so I don't want to lose the contact with people who are more comfortable with the email.
I think that's the tricky question.
So,
a lot of my meetings, we use Google Plus too. If you could have these conference calls be on Google Plus, then you would know who is there, and I think the depth of the communication would increase.
I've begun to realize, I mean, Google has changed a bit in the last few months, which is much more expansive and flexible, and I need a tutorial on how to actually take best advantage of it. I'm feeling a little bit like this is a really cool thing, but how do I actually do that?
Right. I think the whole Google Docs collection of resources are being used a lot more professionally now.
Well Google Plus, you can have Google Hangouts.
Yes, and
Tamara, is there a way to subdivide on Facebook by audience needs? So one thing that seems daunting to me is that, going back through all the teleconferences or going back through listservs or whatever seems time-consuming, whereas if I were, let's say, an educator that was trying to address climate literacy principle X and things...
They should go to the Clean portal then. I don't think that... They can get... No, I don't. The Facebook page is an entity. You can't really subdivide a page. You can just have a new page. And I don't think that's what we want to do right now. I think that if people want guidance on teaching particular things, I think the clean portal is the place to go.
But that's classroom materials. I guess I was thinking of announcements that related to particular topics or domains, but
I don't know that we've to some extent, to a very small extent, compared to what you're asking, it's to a very small extent. In the Clean Community page, we tried to parse out the material that is on the site for different kinds of audiences. But
right.
They're really only very broad audiences. There's the educators, curriculum developers, and partners, and resource developers. So in terms of the Facebook page, that it's not something that's really searchable. It's sort of more timely. So, like for example, if you're advertising to have people participate in, let's say, you want people to come to a presentation, whether it's virtual or face to face, you might put it on Facebook 3 weeks in advance, then 2 weeks in advance, and then a week in advance, and then maybe a day in advance. But eventually, I mean, all of those scroll off so that it's not something that you then go back and search, at least not within a particular page. Things are intended to be timely.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's the way I've seen it. And believe me, I'm not an expert here. When I have issues with Facebook, I ask my daughters.
So Tamara, are you thinking that by having for and I'm sorry if you've already done this and I just didn't notice, was when we have a speaker who's coming on and you showed us some data about particular peaks of when there seemed to be a lot of interest, I pay attention to the email, so I know what's going to be on by email. Have those also been posted on Facebook? And are you thinking perhaps that if the speakers that we do have that come to Climate Literacy Network, if they were announced on Facebook like 3 weeks, 2 weeks, 1 week, 1 day before that it might actually increase participation in those presentations?
Yes, it could. I mean, I do know that when we had Richard Alley give his talk about Earth, the Operator's Manual, we did ask people to advertise this more broadly. And we had a lot more participation. Emails about particular presentations, I generally send an email out the morning of as a reminder. Other than Richard Alley's or maybe some of the others that we had particular, we knew that there would be broader interest in, we didn't really advertise earlier except to post on the website. Now, we certainly could post them on the Facebook page also. Now, I actually have struggled with this a little bit because I guess we could post it both before and after. I hadn't really thought about that. But I was sort of thinking if we post it before the Climate Literacy Network call, then people know what's going to happen. Or we could post it after, and then it has the link to the slides and the
archive.
Recorded the archive, yes. But we could do both, and that sort of elicits. So we could try to have that happen, and I could talk to Liz about how to automatically get that posted.
I like that idea.
So that could advertise.
It also takes care of people who miss it because they don't have that particular time slot available.
That's true. So, but I've kind of been relying on me to actually do the posting, and it's just not efficient because I get very busy and then I don't get to. Get to doing it. But if we can have it somehow that we at least have a standard format for posting about a particular presentation, then that could probably be automated in terms of posting on a regular basis.
That sounds great.
So let me talk to Liz about doing that.
You know, I'm wondering somebody who is very skilled in this area shouldn't just give us a tutorial on how best to manage networks in social spaces and what you can do in Twitter and what you can do in Facebook and how you could best optimize our time and our intent.
I second the motion.
I think,
the key is identifying somebody who can do that.
Yeah, I'm completely. I'm wondering if Megan McVeigh at USGCRP, she worked with Tony Leisowitz at Yale on Six Americas work, and she's I believe in the target age group that is more skilled here.
Uh-huh.
And if not her, perhaps somebody else in the community. But how about I'll take an action item to try and track somebody down. Because
okay.
I need somebody to help me.
I guess this is Jim. I'll have Maureen Moses. I'll talk to Maureen Moses, my staff person that does extensive work with this for us, and see if she would be willing to talk to someone, or maybe even go a little further with it and provide some kind of a tutorial on it. She has done amazing things with this stuff, and she's good with Twitter too. I don't do the Twitter thing, but she also has kind of a balance. I think most people on Facebook, for part of it is, there's some professional stuff on there, but there's also a lot of social stuff, and you take it as it comes. I sometimes go days without looking at it, but then I'm very heavily involved on the weekend with it. And she can explain some of that background and how sometimes our expectations of Facebook, for example, are not quite in line with how people use it. But I'll talk to her. She's on Christmas vacation now, and when she gets back, we go to our annual meeting. But I'll make sure that I'll get back to this group on that, sometime right after our annual meeting.
Okay, that would be great. Because we did in Clean, we tried to have some people talk to us, but they had some knowledge of it, but not enough to make it useful to us. So hands-on knowledge of how to make it useful to us and what we can do that's realistic as well as what we might imagine we could do would be really helpful.
Absolutely. Jim, I like your idea. I'm wondering if a little panel, a little panel discussion between a couple people who are really good at this.
Yeah,
yeah,
I was just thinking that. We've done the panel before, and I think it's a very effective to have a few people with different perspective or different experience participate in a panel. That would be great.
Okay.
Well, we can maybe talk a little bit with Mo at the annual meeting, Frank, and try to set something up.
Fantastic. Sounds like a great idea, Jim.
Okay, just keep me and Scott in the loop so we can get things scheduled.
Will do.
Will do.
Okay. Okay, is there anything else that I talk about today? One more thing. I probably mentioned this at the beginning. Christmas and New Year's Christmas Day and New Year's Day occur exactly 1 week apart. They are both on the next two Tuesdays. So in an unprecedented move in which I think nobody's going to be on the calls on those 2 days, we are going to cancel them.
Thank you very much.
I think since I'm Jewish and Christmas Day is not a holiday for me, I could be on the call that day. However, I think I might be alone. So
I would call in just to say hello.
Oh, really? That's so nice. Well, I've actually, during the summer one year, and I was at a meeting someplace, and I called, and I knew there wasn't going to be a lot of people, because, during the summer, it's a quieter time, and I called in on a Tuesday in the middle of a meeting someplace. I found an empty conference room empty room, and three people called in addition to me, and all three were new and just wanted information about what the Climate Literacy Network was. So it worked out great.
Wow. 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 Very cute. Well, I will wish everybody a very happy season's greetings then.
Okay, I will send out an email after this call that we are canceling this. I wanted to talk to everybody first. I didn't put it in the last email, but our next meeting will be then on January 8th.
Yeah. Very nice.
Sounds good.
Okay. This is Martha. So is there going to be one call that's going to be about social media? Because I'd love to be a little bit part of that. Somebody I think I could bring in from Okay. Google, who does all the Google social media, and I think he'd be
great. I'd like to talk to you actually personally about that, but certainly we can include you in the panel for that. So just keep, if you start getting emails, just keep Martha in mind.
I think it's a great idea, and then pulling it into the context of, you know, lots of times we talk about doing a campaign, and it would be perfect timing.
Right. Very good.
Excellent. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks a lot, everybody.
Okay. Bye.
All right.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.